From Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is the Local Edition, and I'm your host, Jason Dole. Thank you so much for being here with me tonight. Coming up, after a tumultuous year for the local community college, we talked to SUNY Sullivan's president, who's been on the job now for half a year. It's a good time to check in on how he's doing and how the college is doing. It's coming up in the second half of the program. David Potash, long conversation with them. But first up, it's time for the latest news, and we do have some big local news to get to tonight, including updates on Camp Finfo and more. For that, we turn to Ruby Rayner, the River Reporter, who I spoke to yesterday. Ruby, welcome back to the Local Edition.
It's good to be here. Thanks for having me.
So we've got some news to go over, and the first thing is yet another update about the Skinner's Falls Bridge, correct? What's the latest?
Yes. So the latest is different than what previously PennDOT was reporting, but currently they have switched their plan for how they're going to tackle the Skinner's Falls Bridge, and they plan to destroy it with explosive charges. The project team announced that reversal in what they had originally intended to do, which was dismantle the bridge and then store the pieces of the bridge for later, yesterday on Tuesday, December 17th.
Wow. Okay. Well, that's some big news, huh?
Yes, it's different than what news has been coming from PennDOT in regards to the bridge previously.
Yeah, really. So why is this decision now? Why have they changed?
Yeah, so it's surprising not only because of that, but because there was an October inspection report from PennDOT which also recommended repairs to the bridge and didn't mention demolition as a possibility. So for many reasons, it's different. And the project team says that several of the disassembly options that they were evaluating would have involved lowering the spans of the bridge and dismantling it. They were concerned that they wouldn't be able to pick it up and then move it without putting workers and the public in danger. So the project team says after looking at what would really be needed in these disassembly options, that there was a lot of safety risks. And Lisa Brosi, the vice president of consulting firm ACOM, who's working on the project, said that there's just so much deterioration with the structure that they were concerned that it wouldn't survive the pickup and move with a crane. And that it could lead to, you know, the crane collapsing or other safety concerns. And then also that the time frame of how long it might take to assemble it. They had concerns with the season as well as like it affecting land and having greater business impacts and the need to provide safe passage for river users. And so those were the main reasons that were given for this very drastic new plan to explode the bridge.
Oh, my goodness. So I know that there's a lot of community members that care a lot about this bridge. There's been a very passionate defense and request for the bridge to be repaired. Is there any reaction from any of those folks in the community, bridge supporters, to this latest news?
So not as of yet. We are pre-recording this now on Tuesday, and this was announced just today. So this is pretty fresh information, but I'm sure by the time listeners are hearing this tomorrow on Wednesday evening, there will be plenty of reactions from people in the community who were advocating to save the pieces and reassemble the bridge. So I can imagine that there will be quite a bit of reaction to the news, especially since it is such a drastic change from what was originally reported from PennDOT.
speaking of pre-recording a day early, it's because of yet another story that people care passionately about in the local communities that I've heard from a lot of folks about. It's a Camp Finfo, and we're recording this early because you're actually going to be at the next public hearing for Camp Finfo. As this interview airs, you will be at that meeting. We talked a lot last week about the Camp Finfo project and where it stands with this, you know, this environmental impact study. Can you talk just briefly about some of the organizations that are stakeholders that are weighing in on this and who have strong feelings about the Camp Finfo project, and how have they prepared for this hearing tonight?
Yeah, so the hearing that will be going on right now is been heavily discussed by different stakeholders in the community, and all have kind of different stakes in the game. So one of them is the Delaware Riverkeeper Network, a nonprofit organization that's been advocating against the Camp Finfo project application from the get-go, which is, you know, it's been going on now for years. And the network's leader, Maya K. Van Rossum, has attended multiple Highland Planning and Town Board meetings and has publicly tried to rally people and inform them about the application's progress and about the concerns that the Delaware Riverkeeper Network has about it, and has, you know, released several various, you know, petitions and calls to actions at different parts of this process. And most recently, with this public comment period, actually held a strategy session, an online public comment strategy session, in which she was able to, she gave folks advice on how to effectively, this is what it says on the ad for it, effectively advocate during the public comment period. And a lot of their hesitancies about the project moving forward have to do with the river, protecting the river, as well as the environment and the right to water and clean air, and protecting also the inhabitants of the river. So that's where a lot of the concerns come, which is apropos for an environmental impact statement reading. And so I think a lot of the questions that come out of people who might have gone to the Delaware Riverkeeper strategy session will revolve around that tonight.
Okay, and is there another group that's called No Finfo?
Yes, spelled KNOW Finfo. It's a group of concerned residents from the Upper Delaware River region who want to educate the public about the facts and risks involved in the Northgate Resort's Camp Finfo, and that's according to the No Finfo website, which has been created around the group. And, you know, they too have participated in some of the petitions and the other, you know, public comment strategy sessions, and promoted those of the Delaware Riverkeeper Network. And at some meetings in the past have equipped residents who have gone to those meetings with pins and different merch that say No Finfo, and have strongly kind of urged people against the project and to advocate against the project. So it will be interesting to see if there's a No Finfo presence at the public hearing. And then there's one last group who's actually most recently put out an email that has tried to urge community action in favor of the project. The Sullivan County Chamber of Commerce sent an email that asked folks to bring family members, friends, colleagues, et cetera, to advocate in favor of the project, as it's going to be an economic driver. Those are the words used in the email for the Sullivan Catskills, and urged that passion to be expressed in favor in order to move the project along. So there's a lot of different stakeholders and advocating and trying to drum up support in whatever camp they're in. And I'm sure that they will all be speaking at the meeting.
That was great there. And I know that you give regular updates. You follow what's happening at the Sullivan County Legislature. And the big news from the past week is that Sullivan County actually passed its 2025 budget.
Yes, not without some discussion, some friction before the actual vote took place, but they were able to pass the $303 million budget, which includes a 2.5% tax levy increase, and that was an 8-1 vote, and there was only one opposing vote, which was cast by the District 9 legislator, Terry Blosser-Bernardo. Included in the budget, there was an additional funds for a district attorney office investigator to be added to the Sullivan County District Attorney's Office. And at a previous budget public hearing the week prior, the addition of the position had prompted Blosser Bernardo to raise questions about the motives of the district attorney's office. And so before the vote actually took place, the Sullivan County District Attorney, Brian Connedy, addressed those comments in front of the legislature. And I will read his quote here. He says, quote, "The main reason I came here in such a rush was because comments were made that I was running my office in a political manner, and that is the furthest from the truth," end quote. And he went on to compare his office's resources in Sullivan County as the district attorney to those of Orange County's district attorney office and the positions that are there. And there's, you know, far more resources in the Orange County district attorney's office. And so making the point that the addition of the position was, you know, not, there was no other reason to it, but its necessity.
Okay, well, this legislature, since it took office at the beginning of this year, so it's been about a year that they've been in office, seem to be marked by, you know, less friction and disagreement than previous iterations of the legislature, at least in recent history. Is this a sign that any of this is changing?
No, I don't think so. But they discuss things very thoroughly, and they will go back and forth between the legislators and, you know, talk about different points, and sometimes it gets heated, but most of the time they, you know, when it gets to that point of kind of raising their voices at one another, or they're not seeing eye to eye or understanding each other, they will, you know, say some quips maybe back and forth to one another and then kind of move on. And, you know, in this meeting as well, legislator Brian McPhillips, as well as the chair Nadia Reich, you know, got into it about longevity, which is basically adding a bonus for county employees. They were talking about what it would look like and, you know, didn't agree on how to go about doing it. So that was between two Democratic legislators. And sometimes it's between a Democratic legislator and a Republican legislator. But they oftentimes will disagree. They have their second of kind of being, you know, expressing feelings about that disagreement and heightened emotion. And then it kind of dissipates and the legislature continues as normal. And the most that can be observed, at least from sitting there, is that it just makes the meeting a little longer.
Okay. And, you know, included in your reporting, you talk about Detective Jeff Harb, the sheriff's office, and president of Police Benevolent Association Sullivan County, speaking on behalf of the union, saying, quote, "Everybody's being asked to do way more than ever with even less. Our membership is getting fed up. That's why I'm here today," end quote. Can you just real quick tell me what that's about, and anything that they voted on the budget, does that impact that?
Yeah, so the budget included a 5% raise for most management/confidential employees of the county. And I think that there is this ask that if they're going to be raising the pay for management and confidential employees of the county, that that same gratitude should be extended with the county's union contracts, which would include with the sheriff's office. And Harb also pointed out, because he was sitting there for most of the legislative hearing, that this seems to be an issue across the county, you know, with EMS and with fire and with corrections. And so he was, you know, making the point that he's hoping that there will be an acknowledgement and there will be a form of payment to these salaries, an increase when these union contracts are up and the county is looking at them. And the legislative chair, Nadia Reich, responded and said that, you know, she hopes that there's going to be as generous and fair attitude among the legislator when it comes to the union negotiations that they're going to be having as when it comes to management salary increases with the county. So we'll see what happens with those. There'll be a couple in the beginning of the year, yeah, and they'll be a topic of discussion.
Well, we'll see what happens, and we'll be looking to you to tell us what happens. So I'm glad that you're there and keeping an eye on it. And I thank you so much for the news that you brought to us today. These stories are up now at riverreporter.com. We're talking to Ruby Rayner. Ruby, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're listening to The Local Edition, winner of Excellence in Broadcasting Awards from the New York State Broadcasters Association. Radio Catskill. Listen local.
It's The Local Edition. I'm Jason Dole. It's been a tough year for SUNY Sullivan, from a drop in enrollment to the closure of its residence hall, and the college in Lock Sheldrake, New York, recently regained full accreditation from the Middle States Commission on Higher Education. To get up to date on where the college is right now and how it is positioned for the future, yesterday I spoke with SUNY Sullivan's president, David Potash.
David, how are you doing?
I'm doing very well, Jason, and there's a lot of good news to go with the scary headlines that you just provided. I'm feeling very, very good about the college and very, very good about where we're going.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. And you are only about halfway through your first full year on this job. You came on board in the summer and you had your work cut out for you. So I just want to start off there. Just what has this been like for you doing this work in this area at SUNY Sullivan? What has the last 6 months taught you? What's it been like?
Oh, it's borrowing a phrase from my son from when he was little. He's now in his 20s, and he had a very busy day at school, and he came back and he came up with all the intensity of a 4-year-old. And it's like, my day was very full. And borrowing from him, I would say, Jason, that the days have been very full. They've also been extraordinarily rewarding and really gratifying. I feel a little bit like Thanksgiving regularly, because there's just so much positivity in the community around the college. Yes, there are challenges. There are serious challenges. I'm not going to minimize them at all. I would say, though, that the challenges that SUNY Sullivan faces are not necessarily unique to our college. A lot of community colleges are wrestling with similar issues. And I'm fortunate enough to have come from a community college in Chicago. I led for 11 years, and I've been in the business, so to speak, for a while. So with a little bit of that perspective, a little bit of years, you kind of know what you're getting into and take it from there. And it's been a very good almost 6 months. My first day of work was really the July 1st.
So let's talk about the reaccreditation process. Sure. Can you explain what the reaccreditation process involves, and what steps did SUNY Sullivan take to, you know, ensure full compliance and get this full?
Yeah, and college presidents always talk too much and pontificate or whatever. So poke me, mock me if I do that, but I do think it's probably helpful for the listeners to get an understanding of process and. What that is, basically, accreditation comes, used to be called regional, now it's different. It's a peer review process that involves a college sharing a lot of information about what it's doing, how it's doing it, all the rest of it. It's quality, basically a promise of quality. And through that peer review process, where you share some information and get some data, and a visiting team of colleagues come and assesses what's going on. They also make recommendations. So it's a promise as well that the college is making gains. In order for an institution of higher education to give financial aid, Pell, all the rest of it, the federal government requires that an institution be accredited. So it's a big deal. And when you go through accreditation, we're through Middle States. It's an accreditation that handles basically most all of the institutions of higher education in this part of the country. You write a report and share data on a set of standards. And the standards are things like integrity, student learning, all the rest of that. Several years ago, when the college submitted its self-study, the team that visited, and then the following up process, said that there were two areas of real concern, one of which was the college's processes for evaluating student learning assessment. Basically, what do you want the students to know, and do they know it well? And the other one was the connection between that assessment, what students are learning, and the college's planning and budgeting processes. And because these were two items, and everybody takes these real seriously, and Middle States took them real seriously, they said, this is really important. We want the college to submit a report on how they're addressing these challenges, and we want a team of people to come and visit the college and go through everything to make sure that everything you said in the report you're doing, you fixed. So before I started here, the college, through its interim leadership, Dr. Casey Crable, started working on this. I found out about it pretty much in the search process. And when the Board of Trustees said, you know, they were interested and they were kind enough to give me an offer, I started joining the team that was working on it. When I started, that was really an absolute priority. We submitted their report later in the summer. We did all the ongoing work through the summer. A team came in September toward the end of the month, said, okay, we're going to check everything out. The team writes up a report, makes recommendations to the overall commission. That takes a little while. We kept working really, really hard on these issues and other accreditation issues. And we received some really good news earlier in November that said, great, you've met all the criteria. College never lost accreditation, but they said, yep, you were in really, really good shape. And they also asked that we send them a report on learning outcomes assessment next August to show that the good work happening is continuing. So this is an absolutely essential step to the college, not only having a strong foundation, but building that infrastructure. So not only can we promise quality, we can take the guidance, the advice, the criticisms, all the rest through that peer review process and become a stronger institution going forward. And college, just everybody stepped up in really, really good ways. I was just at the Middle States annual conference in Philadelphia, got some more feedback. And we're going to do everything we can, not only to make sure that we not only meet or exceed all those standards, but our next visit, which is scheduled for 2030, we'll start prepping. We've already started prepping for it. We'll be in good shape going forward.
Part of what community colleges are all about is people at different places in their lives being able to, get more education, get a leg up, do something different. And so along those lines of having to accommodate where people are at with their lives, one of the things that the college had was like a residence hall, this last hall for students to stay. That has closed. And I'm wondering, that seems to have impacted fall enrollment. Does the college, what are you doing to address this issue? And what can we say about this?
Absolutely. Well, first of all, I can't speak with any detail about the actual specific plans of the residence hall because it's in litigation. I can share a little bit about that history and where we are. SUNY Sullivan was one of the first community colleges in the state of New York to build a residence hall. And for those back in the day, and I understand that you're an alum, so you might be part of that back in the day. Different environment, different enrollment, different strategies, and a lot of students crowded to the residence hall, and many students really from out of the county were there as well. That model doesn't work the same way now. Residence halls aren't built the same way. They are organized differently, and we do have a separate residence hall on eco dorm that has smaller students that was built in the teens that does fit that model. It's suites with a small kitchens and all the rest of that. That holds approximately 45 students. But the big residence hall, that model no longer works. That end of, I guess you'd call it that model, through us and many other community colleges really stopped during the pandemic. And now very, very few community colleges, both in New York State, but really around the country, are trying to get into the residence hall business. It's a different kind of thing. So during that transition and the closure of that hall, without casting any blame or anything like that. I don't think the college had the bandwidth or the structure to start thinking about new outreach, new models, all the rest of it. And in our analysis, we think that that closure actually hurt in terms of enrollment and structures during this transition. A significant number, probably about 100 students in terms of loss. So what we've started doing is not only marketing and reaching out to students about this smaller residence hall, but also changing some of the ways in which we market programs, student experience and expectation. And we're in the process of thinking about how we can create more of a real quality on-campus experience for those who might be driving to the college, spending a couple days a week with us, food services, study areas, support areas, all the rest of it. Different model than the residence hall, large numbers, but ones which we think some confidence we can provide a really high quality experience.
And as you say, things have changed since that hall was built, and things have changed since I was there as a student. And so that's why I want to ask about St. Sullivan. You know, is facing challenges. So are community colleges, around the country, and continuing higher education more broadly, I think. And yesterday I had a conversation like this with people from my field, media, working in news media, talking about how things have changed and how are we meeting those changes? How are we not meeting those changes, and what are the community needs? So, and I feel like as this whole conversation we have, we keep talking about change, and we're talking in the shadow of bigger changes that are happening in the world, demographically, technology wise, changes in the workplace. So, before we wrap up, I was wondering if you could tell me from your perspective, what is community college in 2024? Like what has changed about the role of this type of institution in the community?
That's such a great question, Jason. And I'm really glad you asked it. I guess what I would say is that, community colleges in many ways are in a role where they are the economic engines of their community when working well effectively. They're a bridge to many, many different things, to many, many different people. And that means that the idea of sort of like the college is a fixed building in a fixed place that you go to, you take your classes, then you go someplace else and you get an education. That doesn't work well for many students. And I'll spell it out really kind of quickly with like our nursing program. What we do with healthcare and nursing is really, really important to the county. Super, 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 super important. That means that we not only will take students who are kind of like traditional or what you think of 19, 18 graduating high school and want to go to college and want to become a nurse. So we help them in set programs, become a nurse, place them clinical placements, work and jobs. But we also get students who have done something different in their late 20s, their 30s, who are career changers, all the rest of it. They want to come back and be nurses. Well, maybe they not be ready for the nursing program, but they will start with us and they will take biology and all of those basic classes that you need to do to get into a nursing program. Then within that, there are also those who want to go to a four-year institution and study nursing. And those who want a degree from us, which will get them immediately placed in the field. So you have to have forks in the program, so to speak, as well. Add to that, there's something called a CNA, a clinical nursing associate degree, which is a shorter term program that is kind of like a bridge for someone who wants to get in the field, but doesn't involve actually becoming a registered nurse. It gets you to that next early stage. The college is going to be offering that program and the spring semester. We're also adding a weekend evening cohort program in the spring semester because we've got people who are working full-time during the day that want to become nurses that have to learn in a different modality at a different time. So what does that mean for it with the community colleges? It means that we've become many, many different things to different people while still remaining true to our mission, which is how do we get folks the education and a quality opportunity that they need. And if you can like read into the future about what media is going to be like in 5 years, we would love to know that as well for the college, because we are working really hard to anticipate what that what that profile might be in 5 years for where, how many people want to be on campus, want to learn off campus, want to learn online, want to learn in different ways, and what those things might be.
Been talking to SUNY Sullivan President David Potash. David, I want to thank you so much for talking to us. I want to wish you a happy new year and the best for the year ahead. Thank you so much.
And I want to thank you, Jason, and it's a special delight to talk to you.